Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined by an author, illustrator, and poet who has also run a cafe and performance space and taught in public schools and treatment centers. She's written and produced spoken word shows, including The Lighter Side of Chronic Depression and Anger, the Musical. Her books include Lonesome and Very Quarrelsome Heroes, Gold Shoes, and the graphic memoir Brontosaurus Illustrated. Leanne Grable, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hello, so happy to be here.
So, Leanne, your book, Brontosaurus, is full of frank discussions of violence and sexuality and other intense subject matter. So I'm just going to take this moment to warn any listeners who might want to opt out of this conversation. That said, let's talk about your book. Brontosaurus is an intriguing title for a graphic memoir. What was the inspiration behind it?
There's an elephant in the room, that saying. Actually, the introduction of the book talks about this. And so I was thinking about that because to me, rape still is an elephant in the room. But then for some reason, I got the brontosaurus in my head and started doing research on brontosauruses. And because they're huge, five times the size of an elephant. So I thought that was an appropriate metaphor for rape, something that still nobody really wants to talk about. So it just seemed like there's a brontosaurus in the room, five elephants. That was the inspiration. And, you know, I wrote this before as a novella, kind of more of a memoir, 12 years ago. And it was called Brontosaurus, Memoir of a Sex Life. I'm not that happy with that book. So I ended up, this newer version with the illustrations, I like it a lot better. I like the writing a lot better. I like the tone a lot better. And of course, I love the drawings. So, and that was inspired by Ellen Forney, an illustrator who illustrated a book that I used to teach, in the Sherman Alexie book, Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. She did the drawings for that. And then she came out with a book called Marbles about her being diagnosed bipolar, and it was fully illustrated. I read that about 4 years ago and I thought, bam, I want to fully illustrate Brontosaurus. And so one summer I just did 300 drawings to go with it. Ran into a book designer, a friend. I hadn't seen her in 15 years. She said, oh, I'm designing books now. I said, oh, would you want to design my book? And so that kind of fell into place. And then the Opiate magazine people want to go into book publishing. So I asked them if they wanted to do my book and they said, yes. So there you have it.
And parts of the book were performance pieces before you wrote them down.
Correct. And in fact, that's what I'm going back to Stockton, California, where I grew up, next week to do a reading, which is going to be crazy because I left Stockton the minute I could when I went to college and really never came back. So I'm working up all these keyboard performance pieces from the new Brontosaurus for that reading. I mean, I do like combination of straight poetry. To me was too boring when I first started going to readings. So I thought, I want to add different media, different things. So I just love images and beats and the whole combination, the whole enchilada. Yeah.
And you're right in the introduction that you love the combination of serious topic with comic illustrations.
Yes.
Which some people might find strange dealing with the topic of rape. You say there are lots of oddities and jokes in the book. All of the stories have jokes. Right. I want you to laugh.
I'm sure I'm irritating people with that attitude. However, this happened almost 50 years ago, and I have approached it in absolutely every emotional way possible. And what else are you going to, I mean, something as dramatic as this, you have to find something besides the dark. I mean, I don't know. My theory, this has become my therapy, even though I went to numerous therapists who I felt did not help. But the expression and all, using whole brain and drawings and the subconscious and everything to tell the story removes it from me. It is no longer feels like a trauma that happened to me. Now it feels like a piece of art or a topic that I can continue, although I don't think I will anymore, turn into an art piece. Otherwise, it's unbearable. Are you kidding? I mean, I don't, you know, I think I don't want to stare that moment in the face and where a rifle was in my face. You know, I don't know. I think it's, you're supposed to tell these stories and jokes. It doesn't mean I'm taking it lightly.
This is a bit of a history lesson as well, because today there are a whole range of resources for survivors of rape. But right. As you say in your book, 50 years ago, there were no kind, braless feminist clinicians in Birkenstocks and Guatemalan ponchos offering their soft hands to generously lead me on the road to recovery after rape. No cushioning, right. No talk of trauma, no talk of healing, no talk of wounds. Nobody acknowledged the ugliness. Nobody gave me advice. I'd never known anybody who got raped. I'd never even heard of anyone. Now, of course, there were people around you who also had stories like yours. It's just they weren't talking about it.
Right. Right. I mean, that's totally true. Nobody talked to me about it. It was just this big cube of silence, sort of. My family didn't talk to me about it. I mean, it's in the book. My brother and mother came a couple days later to the Bay Area to see me, have lunch, and we didn't talk about it. I just told my mom, they offered me a Pepsi and I didn't drink it because it wasn't diet, because there was always the food issue that mothers have with their daughters. You may or may not know this, but you know, it's like, I don't know. No one really talked about it. And then the therapists, when I started going to therapists, I don't know. I expected something to help, but it didn't really help. And I didn't know I needed help. I mean, it was almost like I guess I need therapy. Or people said, oh, you better get some therapy. And I mean, I shook. So I guess I did need a little therapy. Like if I ever got in a situation with a boyfriend or something where the possibility of sexual interaction, my legs would shake.
Now, people might say that your body was holding the trauma.
Yes, exactly. So then I try, and my friend was like, well, you should do something like tapping or EMDR therapy, where you go into a semi-dream state and talk about it. I did try all those things, but I guess I expected instant something and nothing really seemed to change. And the takeaway for me has always been, how do I know what I would have been like if it didn't happen? There's no way to know how it may have impacted me. I may have been just as whatever if it didn't happen as it did happen. And that culminated in going to a therapist, who's the most recent therapist. This was about 4 years ago, who said, actually, I think your father probably did more damage to you just by being an angerholic than this rape did. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned, and you had a series of therapists. This was decades after the rape, but some of them didn't seem to be much more sympathetic than the people around you back in the 70s.
Right.
And you did have this one therapist who told you that she thought the rape was actually the best thing that had ever happened to you?
Yes. That it opened me up. Literally and figuratively, but who knows? I mean, I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mentioned comics artists Alison Bechdel and Ellen Forney and Linda Barry as inspirations. I'm reminded of some of the original women underground cartoonists from back in the 60s and 70s. Artists such as Sherry Flanagan, Phoebe Gleckner, Lee Mars. At the time, they were drawing comics about rape. And that was groundbreaking because it was a topic that was, you know, as you mentioned, ignored and sidelined by the mainstream society 50 years ago.
Right.
So what they were trying to get was visibility for the subject. And some of their comics, such as Trots and Bonnie and Pudge Girl Blimp, did have jokes about rape. for audiences today, that can seem shocking and inappropriate, ironically, but for very different reasons as 50 right. years ago.
You know, I was never a follower of comics since childhood when I was into Archie and Veronica, but no, I was never a follower of that until literally that Alexi book, that style, the simple drawings, I kind of fell in love with that because I'm not a magnificent artist by any means, but I can draw, you know, and kind of the odd croppings and the weird perspective and partial bodies. And, you know, I teach a graphic memoir class in the summer at Manuka, and I told everybody they're all writers and they're saying, I don't know how to draw. And I was like, you just choose what you can draw. If it means that you're just drawing one foot, don't draw the whole family at the table, draw the bowl of peas, draw what you can draw. So that's kind of why I liked Ellen Forney. When I started writing the first version of Brontosaurus, like 15 years ago, I got all the rape memoirs I could find out of the library. And the only one I really liked was Lucky by Alice Siebold. That was actually her first book. And then she had Lovely Bones that became huge. But I liked hers.
Your book, Brontosaurus, the story is not just about the rape, but the relationships you had in the wake of that assault and the thread of that trauma that's running through all of it.
Right. I was, you know, I've done a lot of reading on PTSD, which I'm not sure I really suffer from, but a couple of things stood out to me. The detachment, which I feel like I'm kind of a detached person or have been, sort of you detach emotionally. The other one is sort of this threat of self-destruction that trauma victims often have. And I often thought my choice of relationships until this one that stuck was very self-destructive. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was absurd. I hope I wouldn't have been so stupid if this rape hadn't happened, but maybe I would have been. I mean, it's like, write a list of everything you hate. Okay, let's pick a boyfriend that has all of those qualities, you know. It was ridiculous. And that went on for a long time because I didn't get married till I was 34. So that was a good 15 years of self-destruction.
And you got married while pregnant.
Yes, yes. And I was the person who said, I'm never getting married. I'm never having children. And I'm just about to have my third grandchild. Kind of astonishes me. I never saw that for me. But anyway, yes, here I am, a grandma, Noni.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking today with Leanne Grable. She's an author, illustrator, and poet whose graphic memoir is Brontosaurus Illustrated. Back in the 90s, you and your husband, Steve Sander, you founded the legendary Cafe Lena.
This
and
is true.
That was one of Portland's great little social spaces for performers.
Yep. Yeah, that was 91 to 2001. I liked it for about 10 minutes. Steve thought it was the answer to all his dreams, you know. We have a classic story of standing in front of the dessert case the first week we were open, the first poetry open mic, buzz, 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 all these people. And Steve says, I love this. And I'm saying, I hate this, you know, as Marty Christensen, the poet, he's ordering me around, give me coffee, give me this. And I was like, anyway, I didn't like the cafe. So I rejuvenated my teaching credential after a year so that I could do something else and not work there. But yeah, I was like, I think it just really pumped up the poetry scene. And then those Sunday brunches with people like Kelly Jo Phelps or Annie DeFranco. And it's such a teeny little space. Yeah. I think what happened, Steve got in a car accident And it wasn't, we're not business people. We weren't making money. It was busy, but it was, we didn't know how to make money, basically. And when he got the car accident, he messed up his arm, and it was just like, let's get rid of it. And you know, that woman just came out with that book about dead Portland restaurants. Cafe Lena's featured in there. Teresa Dupay, she's been advertising it. And Cafe Lena has a big chapter.
Well, part of what drew you to Portland back in the late 70s was the community of poets.
Yes.
But poets can be hard to deal with.
Yes. Walt Curtis, I'm sure you know who Walt Curtis is. Yes. I mean, it was him who brought me here, seeing him hosting this open mic at the Earth Tavern the first day I was ever in Portland. And I just went, wow, I love this. I'm moving here. And 2 weeks later, I moved here.
Poets are intense.
Yeah.
And, you know, writers in general, like Catherine Dunn, the late lamented Catherine Dunn.
Right. I know, part of me wants to just forget all the other, you know, the keyboard, just go back to just being a straight poet. But I don't know if I'll do that or not, you know, just for the page, and we'll see. I've always wanted to communicate. I mean, I always thought that was the point of writing. So maybe that's why I sort of added all these other elements to make it more accessible to more people instead of just a deadly poetry reading.
Tell us a little bit about this upcoming novel by filmmaker Penny Allen. You do the you created the illustrations for This Rescue Thing.
Yes. I don't think it's a strong title, but Penny likes it. She went to Thailand to rescue Marjorie Sharp, who was in a prison for mentally disturbed whatevers in Thailand. And she wrote Penny in Paris and said, you need to help me. Penny dropped everything and went over to Thailand with cash and paid off all these Thai gangsters. And I mean, Marjorie was connected to the underworld of drugs and such, and basically got her out of this place and got her kind of healthy again, got her a plane ticket back to Portland. And then at the last minute, Marjorie didn't show up at the airport. So anyway, that was that. And then on Facebook, I had put a link to the Marjorie article, and one of Marjorie's friends read me the riot act about, she didn't need to be rescued. Nobody needs to be rescued, you know. And I had said something like, well, I never met Marjorie in her glory days. And that's true. I never saw the beauty of Marjorie. All I saw was this wasted woman that was always trying to bum cigarettes. But anyway, that's the story of This Rescue Thing. And it's mostly, it's about Penny, really. It's Penny leaving her life and going over there and facing, being so brave. I mean, I think it's really brave to pay off these creeps and go into this prison and so on and so forth, you know.
Yeah, these stories are all about the romantic doomed poets, but not really about the people who keep them alive.
Right, right.
Your rent-paying job was teaching for a long time. And in the book, you mention teaching language arts to incarcerated teenage girls.
Correct. Well, I had a credential. Well, I graduated from Stanford in English after going there with a math scholarship. And a couple teachers said, you're a great writer. You can be a writer. And I thought, oh, good. I'll just write a couple short stories. That'll be it. And of course, that didn't happen. So about 5 years later, I went to PSU for a year to get a teaching credential in language arts, and hated teaching and quit after 6 months. Had a, the only job I could get, because it was mid-year, was in a Catholic school. And I ended up, I think I can't stand authority, I guess, because I always get in wars with authority, but the head nun and I, you know, so I quit.
Fiery Jewish girl going up against the mother superior.
Correct. And I mean, this is interesting and you don't have to use it, but I gave my students a topic that was to write a thing. They were middle school. If you could change America socially or educationally or whatever, how would you change it? She came storming right in and said, God created the world perfectly. It's perfect. You can't, that's an anti-religious topic. But then what happened is the cafe, my kids were getting older. I needed to be making more money. And so someone said, do you want to sub in a treatment center, Rosemont? I don't know if you ever heard of Rosemont, but it was a treatment center for years, decades. And it was these teenage girls in a year of incarceration, messed up, familyless, drug addict, trauma, all rape victims. And they were reading poems the day I visited. And I was just like, oh my God, yes, this is what I want to do. So I subbed and then I went back to Lewis and Clark to get a master's special ed endorsement because I needed a special ed endorsement to keep the job in the treatment center. And I did that for 11 years until I had a fight with the principal again for letting them read Sherman Alexie or letting them look at a photography book by Annie Leibovitz where Patti Smith is standing there with a beer bottle. And he was like, that is such a trigger. That is so, everything I did, he thought was inappropriate. So finally I left.
And in one major irony, one of your students had been listening to the radio,
right,
and heard you talking about your rape. And then, you know, I mean, it wasn't a subject you brought up, but right, you weren't going to back down. So, you know, you gave them the Cliff Notes version, and that was considered really inappropriate, even though
they were, you know, all victims.
They were all dealing with their trauma.
Right. So it was ridiculous. I mean, that's so absurd because I could have been used as a great model. You know, here's a person that had a horrible experience like you that's made a life for herself. And I seem to be a relatively normal person to them. But no, it was ugly. I mean, he turned me over to the state of Oregon and I had the union had to give me a lawyer and I had to go through this 2 years of investigation and all this stuff. He went around Portland and tried to get all of my poetry books out of bookstores and it was ridiculous. In fact, I just threw away all that paperwork. I was going through files. I said, because I was thinking maybe I'll do a theater piece about this, but then I was just like, nah, over. But interesting, a couple people from the Catholic school, and that was 1981, have gotten in touch with me. They were little boys. They were 11-year-old boys. One guy says he's coming to this reading I'm doing on Sunday. And he said he was a victim of abuse like that and that it was really hard for him to read my book, but he wants to come and hear me read and stuff like that. I just was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, you do include in the book, Brontosaurus, you do include some of your students' creative pieces, very short creative pieces about right, how you would personify an emotion.
My favorite thing to do in the classroom is a emotion personification thing, which I believe I got from Peter Sears, the ex-poet laureate. Anyway, he has this great poem called My Emptiness, and it's a complete personification of emptiness and this character sitting in the back seat, throwing his hat out the window and being irritating. Anyway, so I just, that's what I always do in the classroom. They pick an emotion and what kind of clothes would it wear and what does it eat for breakfast and stuff like that. And it just turns out the best work. So I did use a lot of those for the epigraphs in the book.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And we've been talking today with author, illustrator, and poet Leanne Grable, whose graphic memoir is Brontosaurus Illustrated. Leanne, thanks for joining us.
It was great. Thank you for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
My website, leannegrable.com.
Can you spell that?
L-E-A-N-N-E-G-R-A. BEL.com. And there are a lot of readings coming up in October and November, and all that information is there. I am starting this new comedy show with Greg Bielmeyer, the dancer, choreographer in town, and Patty Flynn, a visual artist. We're all similar ages, about aging, because that's definitely a topic that you have to find the humor in it, or it's really irritating.
You kind of have gotten away from poetry now, but you're going to be doing more combinations of prose and poetry and illustrations coming up. You've got a
book coming out. Yeah.
Tell us about My Husband's Eyebrows.
My Husband's Eyebrows. That's coming out the end of October. Yeah, I mean, I just thought I should write about Steve. Poor suffering Steve. Long suffering. No. He lets me have all the acclaim because he actually is a great poet and songwriter also, but he still works for the OLCC. And so he's pretty wrapped up in that. One more year and then he's going to retire. But I just wanted to pull together some of the stuff I've written about marriage. And that's full color illustrations. And it's more prosy. I'd say they're prose poems, actually. And I'm excited about that book, too. Especially color, having it be color.
What does Steve think about all this?
He read it like a million times. And then finally, right when it was really going to press, I said, please read it again and make sure nothing bothers you. And one piece did bother him. And then I said, is there any way I can take out the part that bothers you? And we negotiated a little bit, and he's okay with it. And he's okay with Brontosaurus. I mean, everybody was like about Brontosaurus, the first version. What does Steve think? You shared so much intimate details about your relationship with Steve. What does Steve think? He read it like a million times. I mean, I'm not going to be that mean. Anything that he's in that I write, he gets to read it first to make sure it's not going to shame him. But he's okay with it.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
Strangers for great-grandchildren, I got strangers for ancestors. I was a long time coming, I'll be a long time.